So, hello everyone. Welcome back to Big Ideas on the Go. I'm happy to have with me Joe Gridley, who is the Chief Data Privacy Officer for the University of Maryland. Joe, hello and welcome to the show.
Morning, thanks.
So Joe, I think we have a couple of questions to talk about. Obviously, lots of things going on in privacy land right now. Some dealing with AI, but maybe before we get started and dive into those topics, maybe you could begin by just giving us a little bit of history on yourself and a little bit of overview on kind of what you do at the UMD.
Sure. Yeah. So brief history. I am a recovering attorney. I started right out of law school at a financial firm that managed charitable trusts. One of the things that they were doing at the time was creating a portal, a web portal for their donors to go in and direct funds to go to different places, which of course meant that there were regulations they had to worry about and a bunch of contract language that got attached around security, around privacy, and around IT. It just so happened that I was the youngest attorney on staff by about 30 years at that point. And I've always been kind of a nerd just by inclination. So I got the opportunity to sort of help them define what needed to be done and build that program. I was only there a little over a year. And then my wife and I moved back east to be a little closer to family. From there, I moved into a legacy software company that started in the 70s, actually, believe it or not, those big tape reels and punch cards. They had a museum they kept at headquarters where those were all kept. And of course, they at the time wanted to move into the cloud. And so their customer base was defense, it was healthcare, it was education. And also all these very heavily regulated areas, right? So I spent time, again, kind of developing the control sets and helping to build out the program. And I found at the time, I really started to like that part of it a lot more than I liked arguing about indemnification language in a contract. And that turned out to work out very well because at the time, Penn State was hiring for an IT compliance manager. And they were literally across the street because the software company was incubated at Penn State. And I took that jump. I was at Penn State for 5 years, give or take. And at that point, I had moved from just sort of a directed IT compliance manager that was doing gap assessments to a much broader scope that wound up eventually being an assistant chief privacy officer after some reorgs at the institution. The University of Maryland announced their inaugural privacy officer position opening up. And I thought it was too good an opportunity to pass up. I took it, and here we are.
Here and here are all of us. So, you know, you're the first actually university or education centric CPO we've had on the show. We've had some other privacy pros. I am curious, obviously, you're centered in Maryland, it's right in your name. Is it just the state of Maryland upcoming privacy regulations you care about? Obviously, your students come from all over the place. So maybe talk a little bit about what kind of informs your thinking around privacy, data compliance. How do you and how do other universities think about it?
Yeah, so to start, just a little bit of context that might help. A lot of folks, when they think about university or they think about college, they think about their interaction with it as students, right? And fair enough. You went, you worked with your faculty, and maybe you worked with some of the staff to help you with different things. But that is not really what a higher ed organization on the business side of things looks like. And especially for larger institutions like the University of Maryland, the rest of the Big Ten, the Ivy League schools, all of those kind of R1 universities, they're much, much more like a small city, right? So we have around 50,000 students and around 10 or 15,000 employees, just to give you an idea of what those numbers might look like. We have an airport, we have a nuclear power plant, we have pretty much
So the university has a nuclear power plant?
We do, yeah. Yep.
Oh, how handy.
It is actually, it's really cool, right? My job, half of my job is just living in an issue of Popular Science. And it's cool. It is very cool. But that sort of informed, like that context kind of informs the stuff that we care about, right? It is not just that I am concerned about making sure that like your grades are kept private. I am very concerned as well about our human subjects and the research that's done on them, right? So this is where we get studies both about somebody's favorite flavor of ice cream and about somebody's opioid treatment, right? So it's a very broad category. The sort of regulatory framework that we work under is as much of a nightmare as you might imagine, right? So we absolutely have international students. So we have to worry about things like the GDPR in the EU. One of our largest, two of our largest demographic international populations are China and India. China, of course, just having people that we now need to worry about and think about. India kind of making noises over and over about their version of GDPR. And then, of course, yeah, here in the US, you've got the sectoral based, you know, healthcare is HIPAA and education is FERPA and finance is GLBA and on and on and on, right? So the patchwork that exists in this space is kind of unique for higher ed, right? Because we have such a broad constituency, because we do business in so many different kind of verticals, we wind up pretty far out there on some of these things. So it is both a really cool opportunity to get involved and also a really complex environment to work in.
And do you care? Like, is it your job to care about GLBA and to care about HIPAA? Or yeah. It is. So any kind of regulatory compliance is important to you.
Yes. And for me specifically, if it touches a human being, it matters, right? And
that could be a researcher, that could be a student, that could be this lucky person who's part of the ice cream favorite ice cream flavor study, which I'd like to figure out how to volunteer for that. But everybody, you care about everybody.
Yes, absolutely. I realize that I am nodding along on a radio show, so I'll try to chime in a little more vocally. Yeah. But yeah, it is absolutely everybody that we care about, whether you're a researcher, a student, somebody that interacts, like buys a ticket to come to a football game. It is all part of our program.
And so, you know, this provides a great segue. So obviously AI, everybody's talking about it. You know, I think OpenAI launched ChatGPT 3.5 maybe about a year ago, a year and a couple of weeks ago now. How does AI inform how you operate? I'm sure all of the departments are probably experimenting with generative AI. They obviously are training it, at least in part, on these are pre-trained models, but they probably want to take some of the content and some of the data that they already have, like studies on ice cream. You know, how do you guide them? Why do you do you just tell them, no, don't go to ChatGPT. I'm going to block that API. How do you give me a little bit of sense as to how AI, both emerging regulations, but just in general, in terms of guidelines.
No, I mean, so there's no stopping this train. If I try to stand in front of it, I'm getting run over. So the guidance is absolutely not, do not use these tools. What the guidance, and of course, you know, the different things that AI can do kind of generates the different guidance. So if we're talking about generative AI, we're talking about ChatGPT or DALL-E or whatever, right? The guidance that we tend to give folks is really not all that different than we would give them interacting with any other website. So this is a vendor. It's truly a vendor relationship. They're not us. So if there's not a contract with one of these tools, then it has to be under contract. It's also, you know, for ChatGPT or for any of the others that train their models, essentially the same as posting something to a public website, right? Not exactly, but give or take, that's a good enough thumbnail. We're not just making that up, right? Samsung not too long ago got bit for doing a code review through ChatGPT and giving them, I believe it was Samsung, giving them classified information on a classified project, right? Not even thinking about how that might work. And that, I think, is a lot of the risk that we run from the user perspective, because folks don't think about these tools as things that consume, store, or otherwise sort of transmit or transfer information. That said, again, this isn't going away, right? So I think what we're doing, what a lot of organizations are doing, is sort of building our own infrastructure and building and bringing those large language models in-house so that we can confidently upload anything that we might want that's proprietary or, you know, for example, student information that's specifically regulated. That's kind of the way that we're going to have to deal with that for now. There are, of course, you know, ChatGPT has said, yeah, well, we'll, you know, release an enterprise license and it'll be great. That has yet to significantly materialize. So that is sort of an open question.
Out of curiosity, is the university department of computer science kind of assisting you at all in terms of, you know, how do we create a staging environment? So if we do want to start going down the path of like public source, like Llama or open source models, we want to, you know, are you expecting them to create a clean room of data or kind of any kind of data cleaning or hygiene before they use the data?
Yes, I think to all of that. So we tap wherever we can our faculty members for as much as they're willing to volunteer, because these are like the top minds in the field, right? Philip Resnick, who works at the University of Maryland, is actually the father of some of the large language processing just writ large. So we consult him all the time. And there's all sorts of folks that are sort of experts in their various niches that we bring in, because why wouldn't you, right? And I think that is probably one of the stronger parts of working in higher ed in these sort of cutting edge industries, right? So yeah, absolutely, we bring them in.
Right. So, you know, shifting back, so obviously AI, big topic, not ending. We're kind of right on the 1 yard line. I think there's you have a football kind of a. I think that's a football game. I'm not sure what exactly there's behind you, but looks like some kind of sporting event or at least a rally of some sort. What else are you thinking about and worrying about? Is it the proliferation of new privacy regulations in the US? Is it something different? Talk to me about how you see the next couple of years kind of unfolding in the areas that you have your eyes on.
So I think that the environment in the US is going to continue to get more complicated. I do not anticipate any kind of federal privacy regulation that would preempt all the different state laws anytime in the near future at the federal level. And that's just sort of how we're going to have to live then, right? So now we'll have 50 different regulatory regimes we have to live under just at the state level. You know, what I recommend doing, and I think what a lot of folks in this space are trying to do, is rather than building out your program to meet the CCPA, right, or to meet New York's finance law, whatever the case might be, you kind of pick a high watermark, right? And whether that's the GDPR or the CCPA or whatever, it doesn't matter. But you build your program around those expectations, right? And your program then becomes about principles and implementing those principles. And even if there's a state law and you're missing something, right? Doesn't matter what it is, you're missing one of the 100 things you have to do, you can at least demonstrate that you are making not just good faith efforts, but really sort of best in industry efforts. Because there's no way that you can comply with all of these things. And frankly, if you've got an investigator that's going to come out and check on you anyway, you're getting a fine anyway. So at that point, it really is about minimizing that exposure.
Is there a higher ed organization that you belong to or collaborate? Is there more of you Joes out there? And, you know, I don't know how many universities there are in the US, but I'm sure there's quite a few.
Yes, there is a larger organization that is, the name is EDUCAUSE, and it is an IT in higher ed organization. And these matters, you know, privacy, security, data governance, they all get rolled into that IT concept. So that's where that affinity group lives. You know, higher ed is sort of lagging a bit behind private when it comes to hiring and specifically designating chief privacy officers. So you've got a real mixed bag, and you can kind of tend to see why, right? So the universities that are those small, like liberal arts or state-run teaching universities, are very different funding models than these big research schools, right? And so it's very rare to see a privacy officer at one of the smaller organizations, but the larger ones most commonly do have CPOs.
Got it. And you guys meet like kind of once, is there just like a kind of a Slack channel, or you guys meet once a year? How does that actually go happen?
Yeah, so there's a couple of, there's a large EDUCAUSE conference every year, and there's also a designated cybersecurity and privacy professionals conference every year. So there's two just out of the gate. There are other affinity groups. So like the Big Ten, if you're familiar with the sports organization, right? We have our own academic alliance within that. And so all of the Big Ten privacy officers meet on about a monthly basis. And of course, we all sort of bounce ideas back and forth at really any time of day.
Okay, fantastic. And, you know, maybe just to kind of wrap up, you know, we've talked a little bit about risk a couple of times. Obviously, you have, you're a lawyer by training. You think about regulatory risk. How about security risk? Is that something that you kind of just shove away and say, that's the CISO's problem, not my issue? Or do you collaborate with the CISO, whether it's employees, of which you have very many, you have students that, you know, are still very young and don't necessarily have the best discipline in terms of data handling. So how do you dovetail what you do in terms of regulations and compliance with the broader insider outsider data risk that every organization needs to contend with, especially ones that have intellectual property like UMD?
Sure. Yeah. So one, I mean, we share a wall, right? I can yell over and Jerry can give me, you know, whatever I might need. And that's a good thing, right? I think the Venn diagram for privacy and security shows an awful lot of overlap. And there is some truth to the fact that without a strong security program, you can't have a privacy program. It doesn't matter what we put in place to make sure we're using the data appropriately if it's just out there in an open S3 bucket somewhere, right? Or if it's in our drive space and has been shared with Link to the whole world. That part, there's no privacy there. It doesn't matter, right? So it is absolutely a very close relationship between our privacy and security teams, and it has to be that way.
Okay, so very symbiotic. Look, and I think that's probably, it sounds like it's very similar, I think, what we find in the commercial world as well. I think there's no, you know, you both care about risk and maybe from slightly different angles, but they increasingly, I think there's regulations around the insider and outsider piece. So I'm sure it plays to kind of legal professionals like yourselves. Okay, well, listen, with that, Joe, I think fantastic. I appreciate you coming on the show. And talking to us about some of your experiences complying with some of these emerging privacy regulations, and obviously the particular challenges that you have in higher ed, given the type of sensitive information and the fact that you have people from all over the world, mm-hmm. residents of all kinds of countries and all kinds of states. So I really appreciate it. Thank you again. Any last words from you?
Absolutely. Thanks for taking the time to talk. You know, last words, I think you said this is done for workouts a lot of times. So go out there and kick some ass, guys.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks.